and a large inner office with leather chairs, dark wood paneling, and a new widescreen television sitting on top of a bar. The newspaper office was on one side, and Judd Jr.'s office on the other. They hadn't seen either the newspaper editor or Jr. when they unlocked Judd Sr.'s office. Stryker locked the door behind them, and Virgil said, "Not too much light, just the inner office and the file room. I just assume that not everybody in town knows that we're here." "Probably no, anyway," Stryker said gloomily. He was discouraged by the results of the Schmidt investigation. "Nothing's coming up, man. What about you, anything working?" The letter this morning implied that Bill Judd Jr. has money problems, and mentioned Florence Mills, Virgil said. "It supposedly was set up to make ethanol out of corn and switchgrass, and it's half-owned by George Furr."
"Furr?"
"Yeah. I can't find out who owns the other half, because that half is owned by a Delaware corporation. We could probably find out next week, but it's too late today. We're going to need some papers, and it's already 2 o'clock on the East Coast. I'm thinking that if the Judds are involved with Furr, and, I don't know, there's something going on there. Ethanol. Shoot, it could be another goddamn Jerusalem artichoke scam. There's the same kind of gold rush thing going on. The people who got killed weren't only old. They were mostly pretty well off. Could have been investors in another scam." "Yeah, even the Schmidts. They had a $500,000 in Vanguard," Virgil thought for a second, and then asked, "Is Larry Jensen still out there?"
"Yeah."
"Get him to check the Vanguard statements. There should be monthly statements, like with a checking account. See if there have been any big withdrawals in the past 3 years. Not like for a car, bigger than that." "I'll call now." While he went to call, Virgil began going through Judd's files, looking for anything involving Arno Partners or Florence Mills. Stryker came back. "Larry will check. What are we looking for?" "Arno Partners, A-R-N-O, or Florence Mills. If you could crack open his computer, run a search on either name." "Why don't I do the files, you do the computer? You gotta be better at computers than I am." Judd's computer wasn't password protected, and had almost nothing on it other than Microsoft Word, with automatic formatting of letters and envelopes, with Judd's return address, and a letterhead. Nothing at all in the documents file. The email file hadn't even been set up. A fancy typewriter, Virgil thought. He was closing it down when he caught sight of the secretary's machine in the outer office. Non-networked, both freestanding. "Judd still have a secretary?" he asked Stryker, who was sitting on the floor of the file room.
"Yep, Amy Sweet. We told her to go on home and to send the probate lawyer a bill for her last week of work."
"Gotta talk to her," Virgil said. He dropped behind the secretary's desk, booted up the computer. More files, this time. He ran a search on Arno and one on Florence Mills, and the Florence Mills search kicked out a half dozen documents.
"Got Florence Mills,"
he called to Stryker. He opened the documents one at a time. Payments to High Plains Ag and Fleet Supply in Madison, South Dakota. Stryker came to look over his shoulder. "Son of a bitch," he said, reaching past Virgil to tap the screen. "A payment for 1,000 gallons of Bernard Brand AA. Look at this."
"I don't know what that is," Virgil said.
"Anhydrous ammonia. They've got an ethanol plant somewhere, and they're buying AA. I mean, it could be legitimate if they're growing as well as cooking. But I'll tell you what I think. I think they're manufacturing methamphetamine, bigger than life."
"Oh, man," Virgil said.
"Stryker, I checked Furr with the NCIC. He's had some run-ins with the law since he got out, but they were bullshit. You know, disorderly conduct for protests, that sort of thing. Nothing hard like dope."
"Sit tight," Virgil said.
He got on his phone, called Davenport. "You told me once if I ever needed anything really bad from the federal government, you've got a guy high enough up to get anything."
"Maybe," Davenport said. "I'd hate to burn up a favor on an errand, though.
Call him. Tell him to go to the DEA and see if there's anything on a George Furr. Any possible connection to methamphetamine distribution through one of those fascist white supremacist convict groups. I need it just as fast as you can get it."
"You break it?" Maybe. Not what I thought, though, Virgil said. I'll have him dump it to your email if there's anything, Davenport said. Virgil to Stryker. Do you know any accountants that you can trust who don't work for Judd? One. Chris Olofsson ran a bookkeeping, financial planning, and accounting service out of a converted house on the west side of town. Stryker swore her to secrecy. This is about the murder investigation, he said. Virgil has a hypothetical question for you. Go ahead. She was a bright-eyed, busy, overweight woman, of the kind that drip efficiency. If you had a rich father, a millionaire, I don't know how many millions, and you borrowed a lot of money from him over the years, how would that complicate your inheritance? Virgil asked. She knitted her fingers together and said, That depends. Did the father gift any money to Junior? To his son? They all smiled at each other, acknowledging the fact that she knew who they were talking about. And Virgil said, I don't know. What do you mean, gift? She gave them a short course in the estate tax. When she was done, she asked, So, hypothetically, how bad is Junior screwed? Virgil rubbed his head. We'd have to get down to some exact numbers to know that, he said. I've got some tax records down at the motel, but they're all bureaucratic bullshit, so I don't know if he's screwed at all. He's not a real good businessman, Olofsson said brightly. They should have had an estate plan. Does anybody even know where all of Judd's money is? Was it in trusts or what? Did the killer burn down the house to get rid of planning documents? We don't know any of that stuff, Stryker said. Maybe I ought to run for sheriff, she said. Get in early. Avoid the rush, Stryker said. They both stood, and Olofsson said, Sit back down for a minute. Would you like Cokes? I want to give you my hypothetical. We're in a bit of a hurry, Virgil said. Take you 5 minutes, she said. Cokes? They both took a Coke, and Olofsson said, Suppose Bill Judd had a big tank of money somewhere that nobody knew about but his son. Like money and interest from the Jerusalem artichoke scam. Stryker started to say something, but she held up a finger. Suppose Judd, Sr., starts to fail, first mentally and then physically, and it looks like he's about to die. Once he's dead, any money taken from the account could only be taken by fraud, and the fraud would be pretty visible. The bank says money was taken out on August 1st, but lo, Judd was dead 3 weeks before that. Even Junior smarter than that. In the meantime, the son goes to his accountants, and they say, It's really bad. You've been gifted right up to the limit, so the whole estate is exposed to taxes. Plus, you're so far in debt to him that you're going to owe money to the state and federal government, and they're going to foreclose you. You can't even go bankrupt, because bankruptcy doesn't wipe out back taxes. So what do you do? Virgil shrugged. It's your hypothetical. So the old man is failing mentally, and you're down there in his business office, and you know about this big tank of money. You know the codes, or you have the checkbooks that you need to transfer money to the old man's bank account. And the old man is so far gone mentally, he won't see it. You couldn't give it to yourself, because that would either be fraud or more debt, and it would all be on paper. But if you were willing to forge a signature, if you gave that money to a business that the old man supposedly owned, even if he was too far gone to know that he owned it, and if you had a way to take that money back out of his business, whatever it was, say for services that were never performed? You're saying he was embezzling from his old man? I'm not saying that. I'm saying that if I'm elected sheriff this fall, I'll look into it. Suppose he was pouring money into a corn ethanol plant, Virgil said. She shook her head. The government would take the plant, and any profits should show up in tax filings. You have to remember, you have all this paper. Checks and banks, purchases and sales. The government won't believe you if you say that you lost it. Suppose the profits coming out of the plant were hidden. What I'm trying to tell you is you can't hide it. Not very well. The feds would do the books, she said. They're good at books. Suppose the plant was making two products. The above-ground books worked out to the penny. The underground stuff, there were no books at all. You know, like they make 100,000 gallons of ethanol, sell 90,000, claim they only made 90,000, and sold the other 10,000 gallons as over-the-bar vodka, $2 a quart underground. Then, if nobody gave you up, you'd make some money, she said. But the distribution network, the low unit value of the product, would hardly make it worth the risk. Somebody would talk. And there you are on tax evasion. Virgil took Stryker outside and asked, "You think she can be seriously trusted? No gossip?" "She's been an accountant here for 20 years, since she got out of school. You couldn't get one word out of her about how anybody spent a nickel," Stryker said. "And nobody'll get a word out of her about what we were talking about. She's like a Swiss bank." Virgil said, "I got a lot of paper from St. Paul. Tax records, corporate stuff, stuff I took out of the bank. It really needs an accountant, somebody who can work it overnight." "Ask her," Stryker said. "You'll have to pay her, but there's no question about trusting her." "We can pay her. We need the analysis." They went back to Olofsson, and she agreed to do it. "Too many people dead. Of course I'll do it. I'll even give you my state rate. Overtime, of course. Rush job." "And that would be?" $110 an hour," she said. Sounded like a lot, but then it was only for 8 or 10 hours. "It's a deal. I'll go get the paper, you type up an agreement, and I'll sign it." Back out on the sidewalk, Stryker said, "If you're supposedly developing an ethanol plant, but what you're really doing is using the plant to buy bulk chemicals to manufacture methamphetamine. I mean, we're not talking about a coffee pot on a stove somewhere. We're talking about tons of it. The profits wouldn't be $2 a quart. The profits would be astronomical. You'd need quite a bit of upfront money." "From the Judd Money Bin. And you'd need a distribution network." "From Fur, if he's really involved in it." They looked at each other, and Virgil said, "Let's check back at the hotel. Maybe Davenport's guy got me something." Davenport's guy was Louis Mallard, who was something large in the FBI. He sent along a single paragraph. "A Reverend George Fur of the First Archangelus Church of the Revelation was one of a number of people under surveillance in Salt Lake City and in Coeur d'Alene for his association with extremist anti-government groups like the Corps. The Corps was known to distribute drugs, including cocaine and methamphetamine, to finance its activities, and for the purchase of weapons. Surveillance was terminated after 3 months with no evidence of Fur's involvement in illegal activities, although he had extensive connections with people who were involved in illegal activities." "That's it," Stryker said. "He's involved. He's got the connections." "What about Roman Schmidt and the Gleasons?" Virgil asked. "I don't know about the Gleasons, except that they had some contact with Fur. There was that Book of Revelation. Maybe they were investors. Roman..." "What?" "Roman was pals with Big and Little Curly," Stryker said. "Guess who patrols West County?" Stryker asked. "Big and Little Curly?" "That's their country out there," Stryker said. "They know it like nobody else. If you were moving a lot of meth around, it'd be useful to have a lookout with the sheriff's department." "Hate to think it," Virgil said. "So would I," Stryker said. "I'd rather lose the election than find that out." They sat staring at the laptop screen for a couple of minutes. Then Virgil asked, "What are you doing tonight?" "Thought I'd go see Jesse," Stryker said. "I've got something going there. I don't know, but the case comes first. What do you have in mind?" "I don't want to talk to the Curlies. I'm thinking we might want to do some trespassing. Fur and Judd have the ethanol plant over in Sodak. So what's his farm all about?" "What I'm thinking is, it's the distribution center. He's way out in the countryside. He has those religious services. There are strangers coming and going from all over the place. Not unexpected with that kind of church. Might be when they move the stuff. Lots of guys in trucks." "If we're going to do it, best to do it late," Stryker said, looking at his watch. "It's almost 4 now. I wouldn't ask, but I'd be a little worried going out there without some backup," Virgil said. Wait until the town goes to sleep, and move, Stryker said. Meet me at my place at 1 in the morning. See you then. You bring some serious hardware, Virgil said. Stryker nodded. I'll do that, for his boys have some heavy weapons out there. One good thing, Virgil said after another minute. What's that? You still get to see Jessie. She's got me if she wants me, Stryker said. He seemed puzzled by it all. I looked in her eyes last night, in that candlelight, and I thought my heart was going to explode. Where are you going tonight? Virgil asked. Stryker shrugged. I don't know. Jesus, thinking of someplace interesting just about kills you. I can't take her out to the club. I'm afraid to go to Tijuana Jack's or any place in Worthington. It's just too close, and I really don't want to be seen out on the town. Not yet. Life sucks, then you die. Easy on the die stuff, Stryker said. I'm a little nervous about sneaking up on Fur. Chapter 13. Virgil was stuck. With the accountant working the records, he had nothing to do until 4, and then he had a date, and the date wasn't going to help with the investigation. On the other hand, wandering around town wouldn't help much either. Time to talk to Judd, and look at other names in his notebook. Suzanne Reynolds, the overweight ex-sex groupie. Judd first. He went downtown. A guy at the Super America, gassing his truck, waved at him, and Virgil waved back. Parked in front of the Great Plains Bank and Trust, looked at the Red Wing jug in the window of an antique shop, and strolled down to Judd Jr.'s office. His office was a mirror image of his old man's. Same dark wood generating financial gloom, a secretary at a desk behind a railing, 2 wooden chairs for visitors to wait in. The secretary said, Mr. Flowers, let me see if Mr. Judd is available. The door to Judd's office was open, and she stuck her head inside and said, Mr. Flowers is here. Judd said, Send him in. Judd was wearing half-frame reading glasses, looking at a printed-out spreadsheet which he folded and pushed to one side of his desk. He pointed at a chair and asked, You getting anywhere? Somewhere, Virgil said. Can't tell you how I know it, but I can tell you for sure that I've upset somebody. That's good. Judd said. That's something. I got a question for you. I don't know how far you've gotten in working through your father's estate. The Jessie Lehman deal is going to hose me off pretty good, I can tell you, Judd said. Well, that's something else. Well, I think there's a question of whether she might have wanted the old man to disappear, Judd said. That's being looked into. By the sheriff, personally, is what I hear. By me, Virgil said. Anyway, where'd your old man stick the money from the Jerusalem artichoke business? Judd looked at him for a minute, then barked. He'd laughed, Virgil thought. Virgil, there is no money. There's no secret account. As far as I know, there wasn't much to begin with. And believe me, some very sharp investigators from the state and from the IRS tore up everything they could find. It does not exist. You're sure? Judd tapped his desk a few times, then sighed. Look, how can you be sure? My dad grew up poor, and he was a hard-nosed son of a bitch. Came out of the Depression and made his own way. So he might have hid some money, if there was any. But if there was, he would never have told a soul. I mean, if he had it, it was a crime, and he wouldn't have taken any chances with that. But then the money just would have been lost. Judd wagged a finger at him. Not lost, if someday you needed it. Like with anybody who dies with money. Say he had an account in Panama or somewhere, invested it in overseas securities. The investment would grow, and if he ever needed it, he could get it. He never needed it. You're sure? It's not that I'm sure. I'm not sure about any of this. What I believe is, there never was any money. You're wasting your time looking for it, and if somebody killed him trying to get it, then the murder was a waste of time. There is no Uncle Scrooge's money bin. They talked for a couple of more minutes, then Virgil was back on the street. Looked in his notebook, found the address for Suzanne Reynolds, and headed that way in the truck. Thinking about Judd. And who the heck was Uncle Scrooge? Reynolds came to the door of her house, blinking in the sunlight. She'd either been dozing or watching TV, and her heavy face was clouded with sleep. She opened the door and said,
"You're Mr. Flowers?"
"Yes, I am," Virgil said, holding up his ID.
"Michelle said you might be coming," she said.
She pushed open the door. Virgil followed her past the kitchen into the tiny living room. Reynolds wasn't overweight, but rather was morbidly obese. Virgil thought she must weigh 300 pounds, though she was no more than 5'4". The house stank of starch and fat, and doors and windows not opened. In the living room, a plate with 3 cold surviving French fries sat next to an open jar of mayonnaise. She picked up one of the French fries, dipped it in mayonnaise, pointed it at a plush magenta lazy boy, said,
"Sit down,"
and ate the fry. Virgil sat down and said, "I'm talking to people who had relationships with Bill Judd Sr. back in the 60s and 70s. I'm not trying to mess anybody up. I'm trying to figure out if there was anything back then that could have led to these murders. All the people were of the same age."
"Seems like you're a generation too late, then. They're all 20 years older than us girls were."
"Yeah, but you're what I got," Virgil said. "Let me ask you this, privately, between the two of us. Did the Gleasons or the Schmidts or the Johnstones have anything to do with this whole relationship thing with Judd?" She was taken aback.
"The Johnstones? Are the Johnstones dead?"
No, I should have made that clear. It's just that they were people of this age who might have been involved in something that would snap back. We're thinking it had to be serious. Revenge. Something that festered. Since Gleason was a doctor and a coroner sometimes, and Schmidt was the sheriff, and Johnstone was the undertaker.
"I see where you're going," she said.
She thought about it and then said,
"The only things I can think of are the Jerusalem artichoke business, and then the sex. Maybe somebody's husband just found out about the sex and couldn't stand the thought. But this was a long time ago. People get over stuff like sex. It's just a little squirt in the dark. No big deal."
"Some people think of it as a little more than that," Virgil said. "Michelle told me that it might have been the best part of her life. The most fun, anyway." A wrinkle spread across the lower part of Reynolds' face, and Virgil realized that she was smiling.
"She was a crazy one," Reynolds said. "She liked everything. Boys, girls, front, back, upside down."
She shook a finger at Virgil.
"Here's something. Polaroids were a big deal back then, and Bill used to take some pictures. You know, homemade porno? You could even get Polaroid slide film and take the pictures and develop them yourself, and then have slideshows."
Virgil was getting uncomfortable.
"You think some of those pictures..." "Well, suppose somebody's daddy or brother or husband got a picture of some guy's getting his little girl airtight. That could set something off," she said.
Airtight. He'd Google it later. "Michelle said she only knew of one other guy who took part. The postmaster?"
"There were more than that," she said. 2 or 3 more. "But not all from right here. Not all the girls were from here either. There were some that came down from Minneapolis. One used to come down from Fargo. But like I said, those things fade away. Who cares when you're 55 and fat? If I were you, I'd be looking at the Jerusalem artichoke scam. That's what I'd do."
"You think that might be more combustible?" She shook her finger at him again.
"Listen, you're not from here. That thing, you had to be here. There were old men crying in the streets. People lost everything they had. Borrowed money against their homes and farms. Lost every damn dime of it. Lots of people. If you lost your farm in the 80s, you wound up working in a meat cutting plant somewhere, or going up to the cities and working the night shift in an assembly plant $5 an hour. Can't even feed your kids. That's what could come back on you. That's what could come back."
"You think?"
She nodded. "Us girls, we were playing. It was in the 60s and everybody was playing. But the artichoke thing, that was real. Screaming, insane hate. There were people who would have hanged Judd if they could have gotten away with it. And I'm not fooling. He was lucky to live through it. You'd hear people talking about taking their deer rifle out and shooting him down. Talking out in the open, in the cafe. She stopped talking for a moment, and Virgil watched her. And then she said, "And what made it worse was, Bill was laughing at him. His attitude was, too bad, losers. He was laughing at him. And there was little kids eating lard sandwiches. Lard sandwiches."
At 3:30, he was back at the motel, got cleaned up, thinking about Reynolds in her dark living room with her French fries and lard sandwiches. She'd once been a pretty girl, he'd been told. He met Joan at 4 o'clock. They stopped at Johnny's Pizza, found that they agreed on sausage, mushroom, and pepperoni, and the inherent evilness of anchovies. "A little spooky going back to the farm," Virgil said, as they rolled out of town. "Keep an eye on the back, see if there's anybody trailing us." "You don't have to trail anybody out here," she said. "If you see Joan Carson heading out of town on this road, it's 95% that she's going out to the farm. There's not much else out here." "Didn't think of that," he said. "Besides, we're not going to the farm," she said. "We're going up the hill behind it. That's as nice as the Dell in its own way. And I want to see where that guy was when he was shooting at us."
"I was already up there," Virgil said, "first thing this morning."
"You were?"
"It was a shooting site, Joni. I had to go up and look around," Virgil said. "Didn't find a thing."
"Did you go to the Flat Rock?" she asked.
"What Flat Rock?"
"Ah, didn't go to the Flat Rock."
She was being mysterious about it.
They went past the farm, followed the road around behind the hill, cut into the hillside where the shooter had gotten off, and where Virgil was that morning. Joan looked over the spot where the shooter had hidden his truck. Then Virgil got the shotgun out of the back of the 4Runner and walked her along the now faint track through the weeds to the stump where the shooter had made his nest. The day had turned hot, the humidity climbing, and far down to the southwest they could see the puffy white tops of clouds that would become thunderheads. The world smelled of warm prairie weed. "He might not have known the hillside that well," Joan said when she saw the shooting nest. She pointed far down to her left. "There's a spot down there where you can come in. That's where kids come in when they're sneaking out to the Dell. Good hidden place to park, too. Then you'd come up from the side of the Dell where there's a really sharp break. We never would have seen him. He would have been right over our heads."
"So he messed up in a couple of ways," Virgil said. "I was wondering if he meant to miss us. But I can't see why he would, and he wasn't that far off. If he meant to miss us, he was playing a dangerous game."
They probed around some more, then headed back to the truck. Joni pointed him west, to a clump of shrubs where they left the car, out of the sun.
"Ground's too broken up above here. You can screw up a tire," she said. "Get the pizza. I'll get the blanket and cooler."
She led the way up the hill to a formation that almost looked like an eroded castle, a natural amphitheater in the red quartzite, at the very summit of the hill. They found a spot with shorter grass, in the shade of a clump of wild plum trees, and put down the blanket. Virgil braced the shotgun against one of the trees.
"I need pizza," Virgil said. "Beer. Hot out here."
"Get a beer. I'll show you the Flat Rock. Put the pizza on the rock in the sun. It'll stay warm." He followed her across the hillside to a narrow bed of flat red rock, 20 feet long, 6 or 8 feet wide, sloping just a few degrees to the south. When he saw it, Virgil thought, "Blackboard." And Joan said, "Look." He looked, but he didn't see for a moment. Then he saw a handprint, a small hand, the size of a woman's, then another, and another, and then a cartoon arrow with a tip and fletching, and a turtle and a man with horns, and then more hands, and circles and squares of things that he didn't recognize.
"Petroglyphs," Joan said, "chipped out of the rock, pecked out with another stone, something between 300 and 1,000 years old. There are older ones at Jeffers, but these are pretty old."
"Jeez, Joni."
Virgil was fascinated. He got down on his hands and knees, crawling around the rock. "How many people know about these things?"
"The Historical Society people, and folks who are interested in petroglyphs, and who won't mess them up. My grandfather told a reporter that there used to be a circle of stones here,
not this red quartzite. They look like glacial rocks or river rocks. They were arranged around the flat rock like a clock, and each stone had a symbol on it. People stole them over the years. Nobody knows where they are now. Probably some big museum or Manhattan decorator shop or something. Look at this. He was pointing. That looks like an elk. Did they have elk here? That's what they say. There are three buffalo over in the corner up here. There's a magazine article in this, Virgil said eventually. Something about plains hunting in the Indian days. Take a lot of photographs. Mess them around in Photoshop, make a story out of it. Leave them alone, Joan said, shaking her head. It's nice to know that they're out here, that they have nothing to do with magazines or television. So they sat under the plum trees and talked, ate pizza, drank beer, and watched the thunderheads grow from white globes into pink anvils as the sun slid down in the sky. Joan gave him a talk. I was thinking about us last night, and I don't think this is a real relationship. You're my transition guy. You're the guy who gets me back into life and then goes away. Why am I going to go away? Virgil was feeling lazy, lying back in the blanket, fingers knitted behind his head as a pillow, and he didn't disagree. Because you are, she said. We'd be serious about as long as one of your marriages was serious. You're a good guy, but you've got your problems, Virgil. You manipulate. I can feel you doing it, even if I can't figure out what you're doing. That would drive me crazy after a while. And I have the feeling you're pretty happy when you're alone. That doesn't sound so good, he said. Well, you're going to have to figure yourself out, she said. Anyway, I'm not giving you the gate. I'm just saying, we're not for all eternity. We are not, she agreed. But the sex has been grand. I didn't even remember how much I used to like it. My husband, I don't know, it just got tiresome. He was more interested in playing golf than playing house, that's for sure. Good player? Virgil asked. Not bad, I guess. The last year we were married, one of the most intimate things we'd do is lay in bed, and he'd tell me about every one of 77 shots on the golf course that day. The club, the ball flight, what happened when it landed, bad breaks, good breaks, what he was thinking when he putted. But you know, someday you just gotta grow up. Why'd you marry him in the first place? Virgil asked. He was good-looking, hard worker, available, she said. There are worse things in the world. Yeah, but he just didn't flip my switch, she said. She plucked a long grass stem and nibbled on the butt end. I thought we'd grow into it, but we didn't. A lot of women think men are like raw lumber, something that you can build a house out of with a lot of hard work, Virgil said. But some guys, you know, they're going to do what they're going to do. Can't work with them. They're not good lumber. Is that what happened with your wives? Oh, no. I just married them because they were hot and I was stupid. Actually, all of us were stupid. Didn't know what we were doing. Somebody had to work. Couldn't go dancing all the time. They were still talking about it, watching the birds, arguing about whether the thunderheads were coming in or would slide to the south, eating pizza. And a slice of a woman's laughter slid over the hillside, like a butterfly, fragile, attractive, and definitely there. "Who's that?" Joan asked, sitting up. Virgil shrugged. "I haven't seen anyone." "Somebody's in the dell," Joan said. "Come on, let's sneak up on him." Virgil thought, oh no, Stryker. Joan, maybe it'd be better, you know, let it go. Don't be retarded, she said. Come on, we're missing something. Joan, I think it might be Jim and Jesse. She looked at him for a moment, a wrinkle appearing between her eyes. Then amused, she said, so what? Let's go, you sissy. And she was off across the hillside, using the scrub brush as cover, moving through the weeds in a crouch, a country girl's sneak. Instead of approaching the dell from the top, she led the way around to the north side, and then got down on her hands and knees as she crawled up to the edge of the bluff, where they could look down into the pool. When Virgil eased up beside her, she whispered, "Oh, my, I never suspected Jim even knew about that." Stryker and Jesse were on an air mattress on the same rock where Virgil and Joan had left their clothes and bags. Jesse was naked, on her back, her hands on Stryker's head, which was between her thighs. "That's disgusting," Virgil said. "They're like a couple of animals."
"Shh, they'll hear you. Did you tell Jim about doing this, or did he think it up on his own? I'd hate to think you were sharing our little secrets."
"Believe me, I'm not sharing our little secrets," Virgil said. Joan said, "Oops, here we go. Main event." Stryker was moving over Jesse, stopped at her navel, her breasts. Joan pulled at Virgil's belt buckle.
"Get your pants off, Virgil. Jeez, come on, hurry up."
"Joan, this is terrible. Come on." She was slipping out of her jeans.
"This is really good."
"What could a guy do?" Virgil wondered, as he slid out of his jeans. "But try to be polite." On the way home, Joan said, "I've known Jim every day of my life. I've got a picture of him holding me. I'm all wrapped in a baby blanket when I was a newborn. He's always been guarded, quiet, reticent, one of those guys with muscles in his jaws. I couldn't even imagine him letting it out like that."
"He let it out," Virgil agreed. "He's also a smart guy, and sooner or later you could let it slip that we were up there. That could ruin something for them."
She considered that for a second and then said, "I will never say another word about this to anybody, including you."
"Are you planning to think about it when you're in bed with somebody?"
"Think about what?"
But he glanced at her a few seconds later and caught her smiling. She said, "Shut up." He said, "Incest, that's what it is. One of those Greek things."
Virgil had moved to the second floor of the motel so he could sleep on the bed. He brought up his laptop and checked the National Weather Service radar out of Sioux Falls. The line of thunderstorms that he and Joan had seen brewing to the southwest were about to roll into Sioux Falls, slow moving at 10 miles an hour or so, getting stronger. No talk of tornadoes, but there was a severe thunderstorm alert for parts of northwest Iowa, southwest Minnesota, and southeastern South Dakota. Could be raining when they got to Furs, which might not be bad. Rain and wind would cover movement and scent. Virgil wasn't worried so much about electronic sensors as dogs. He hit the lights and climbed in bed, looking for 2 hours of sleep before he met Stryker. A lot going on. He hadn't fully digested the Fur-Judd involvement and all its implications. He and Stryker had made some leaps in their assessment. Maybe they'd find out more tonight, and maybe the accountant would have more in the morning. The killings could easily have been carried out by a crank freak. The shit stirred people's brains around. Take one of those grim, abused country kids you see from time to time, that thousand-yard stare, mix in some nutcake religion, a convict's point of view taken from the core, plus a little methamphetamine, and you could grow yourself a genuine monster. That photograph of the dead woman that he'd taken from Schmidt's safe deposit box, that came from way back, when Fur would have been a kid. What was that all about? And then, of course, there was Joan's assessment of his, Virgil's, personality. A lot to think about. As he was drifting off to sleep, his alter ego, Homer, popped up in his mind. The shooter humped over the hill, moving low through the weeds. 100 yards down the slope, he could see Homer and Joan in the pool, naked as jaybirds, chasing each other around. He eased down behind a stump to look them over with the scope. Variable power, 2 to 8, and it took a minute to crank it all the way up to 8. That narrowed his scope picture, but he could see their faces clearly enough. He'd become aware that he wasn't quite in the right spot. If he'd come in from the side, if he'd hidden his car in that grove of trees down to the right. Virgil's unconscious rider hesitated. Why hadn't the shooter parked down there, in that grove? Then he was asleep. Chapter 14. The alarm kicked him out of bed at 12:30. He sat up, yawning, jumped in the shower, brushed his teeth, dug a tab of Modafinil out of his dop kit, popped it, dressed, and was out in his truck at 5 to 1. The streets were still dry, but the lightning was close, off to the west, and the moon passed in and out of ragged fingers of cloud. He was at Stryker's by 1 o'clock, a cool breeze slipping down the streets, the leaves on the trees beginning to stir. He parked in the street and saw Stryker moving behind a dark picture window at the front of his house. A moment later, his garage door started up. Virgil got the shotgun and his pistol, a bottle of water, 2 Snickers bars, a pocket flashlight, his rain suit, and a couple of Ziploc bags full of extra shells. Stryker backed into the street, and Virgil climbed into the passenger seat, and they were halfway up the street before Stryker turned on his headlights and asked, "You bring a rain suit?" "Yep." "You awake?" "I'm fine." He flicked a finger at the lightning to the west. "Probably won't need the water bottles." "Look pretty interesting on the radar," Virgil said. "You know where we're going?" "Right down to the foot. We'll be walking in from 3/4 of a mile out. Gonna be darker than a bitch, but we'll mostly be on the road." "Lightning will help," Virgil said, "as long as we're not hit." They were clearing the town, the last few lights fading behind them as they took the road north toward the Stryker farm, then turned west toward Furs, coming in from the back. Good thing about rolling out in the night, Virgil thought with a tight smile, was that he could put some talk and time between the afternoon at the Dell and the next time he had to look Stryker in the eyes, in daylight. If he'd had to do that, first thing, Stryker would have known that something had happened. He'd have seen it in Virgil's eyes. He was a good enough cop that he might have figured it out. Stryker said, "After we split up this afternoon, I walked over to the Ag Extension Service to look at their photo set for the county. The photography was 6 years old, but Fur hasn't built anything new out there. There's the house, where you've been. There's a big garage and shop in the side yard. That would have been on your left as you drove in. I saw that Quonset hut. It was in pretty good shape." "Yes." "Then there's the barn out back. That was remodeled into a meeting room, and people who've been inside say it's pretty open. They have meetings on Wednesday and Saturday nights. Sunday mornings, 50-60 people come from 100 miles around. The sheds next to the barn don't look like much. They must be 80 years old. So the places to look are the Quonset hut, the barn, and the house. I've been in the house. One room, anyway, didn't look like much. I've been in that. There's a basement. Haven't seen it. The shed is what I'd like to get a peek at. If they're moving drugs through in bulk, that's dangerous stuff. They might want to keep it outside the house." "Are you thinking about going in?" Virgil asked. "I'm more thinking about watching for a few hours. See if anything isn't right. Look for dogs. See if there's any security stuff. See if we can smell anything. Look for any precursors." "Didn't see any dogs when I was out there," Virgil said. "That's good. That's the best thing. Most people don't know it, but dogs can see almost as well at night as they can in daylight. Burglar alarm won't hunt you down like a dog will." The darkness deepened as they got away from the lights of town and as the clouds spread overhead. Then they crossed the top of a low hill and Stryker slowed and killed the lights. They were on gravel, creeping along, the lightning nearly overhead, with Stryker staring at a GPS screen. Then he said quietly, "We're there." "Can't see a damn thing," Virgil said. "I left a rock out here," Stryker said. He'd put a couple of strips of black gaffer tape over the interior and door lights, and he said, "Be right back." He shifted into park, climbed out of the truck, and using a pen light, walked down the road. He was back in 15 seconds, climbed back in the truck. "We're right there." He shifted into drive, rolled forward 30 feet, then hooked through the ditch and powered blindly up a low rise and then down the other side. He stopped once, got out, walked, flicked the light a couple of more times, then pulled ahead and again turned blindly to the left, drove another 30 feet. In the illumination of a lightning stroke, Virgil saw that they were about to plow a stand of sumac.
This is it.
What is it?
Used to be a farmhouse. The Miller place. Abandoned and dangerous. The fire department came out a couple of years ago and burned it down for training. Filled in the hole where the root cellar was. But there are still the windbreak trees that used to be around the house. We're back in what used to be the side yard, so there won't be any reflections off the car if somebody comes down the road.
Virgil got a shotgun, and Stryker popped the back hatch of the truck and took out a long gun of some kind. In another flash of lightning, Virgil saw that it was an M16-style rifle, and Stryker had loaded an extra-capacity magazine.
Is that semi-auto or full?
Stryker racked around into the chamber.
Semi-autos for people who shoot prairie dogs.
Using the penlight, they walked back out to the road, and then single file along it. There was enough lightning that they could navigate by the flashes, and Stryker's GPS homed them in on the fur place.
They were making noise, Virgil thought, crunching along on the gravel, and with the sit sound of their nylon rain suits, as their legs crossed and their arms worked. But it was nothing in the wind.
400 yards out, they crossed the ditch again, and eased over an old barbed wire fence. Stryker was talking quietly, almost muttering.
Go slow and watch your footing. There's a lot of rock around. This used to be pasturage. The plowing land was on the other side of the road.
And they stumbled a few times, closing in. The wind was coming up, not howling exactly, but strong and gusting. There were lights at the house. Night lights, Virgil thought, and a bright sodium vapor light above the loft door on the barn, and another on a pole in front of the machine shed. The pole light shook and trembled in the wind. They found a spot, 100 yards out, in a cluster of thistles, and sat and watched. 15 minutes. 20 minutes. Half an hour. Nothing changed in the houses or outbuildings. Then the rain came, spattering through the weeds, and they could hear the change in pitch when the main front hit the road in front of Fur's place. Another note when it hit the steel buildings. And a few seconds later, it was on them. A minute after that, a second-floor light came on in the farmhouse, and then another, the second one from a small window directly below the peak of the house.
Taking a leak, Virgil said to Stryker.
Another minute, and the bathroom light went out, and then the other. Back in bed. The rain was beating on them now, and they sat on their feet, heads down. Hands in their side pockets, dry, but not especially warm. Another half hour, and then Stryker nudged Virgil and said,
"Might not be a bad time to look at the machine shed."
"Lead the way." They crawled and duck-walked in, moving quickly between lightning strikes, freezing with every flash. 5 minutes after they left their watch post, they came up behind the machine shed. At the side door, Virgil tried the knob. Locked. No give at all. They put their heads together to block as much light as they could, waited for a lightning flash, and then Stryker hit the button on the penlight. And Virgil said, "Uh-oh." "Medico locks and almost new. I didn't even know you could get these things out here."
"What?"
"Medicos. Look at this door," Virgil said. "This thing has got some heft to it. Steel, I think."
"We're not getting in."
"We're not getting in," Virgil said.
"So?"
"So let's go and sit some more." They moved back slowly, a little of the stress leaking away. They couldn't find their original spot, but found another just as wet.
"So they got steel doors and great locks. That makes it a little more interesting," Stryker said.
20 minutes later, sputtering in the rain, he said, "I'm starting to feel like an asshole." Another 20 minutes, and the main slab of thunderstorm had passed, and the wind had shifted, and they were able to sit with their backs to it. Stryker said, "We knew it'd probably be a waste of time."
"Yeah, but after you come out here, you kind of expect something to happen because you made the effort."
"Don't work that way, grasshopper," Stryker said.
"Sun comes up at 5:30, more or less," Virgil said. "We should be out of here 20 minutes before that. Virgil looked at his watch. Not yet 3. So, we sit for 2 hours and maybe get some sleep. Not gonna sleep out here.
The rain stopped, the wind dropped, and the lightning rolled away to the east. Virgil had given up hope of getting anything useful when he saw headlights bouncing up the road to the south. As far as he knew, Furs was the only place out this way. He nudged Stryker, who was head down, and maybe sleeping. Stryker's head popped up. He saw the lights and said, "Who's this?"
"Early riser," Virgil said.
They were both stiff, and they stood up, their bodies obscured by weeds, even if somebody had night vision goggles, and stretched, and watched as a pickup truck slowed, pulled into Furs' yard, and then slowly backed up to the machine shed. The driver got out and walked over to the house, skirting a puddle in the middle of the drive, and then stood on the porch waiting. Lights came up, and a minute later the driver was led into the house.
"Let's go see who it is," Stryker said.
Back through the weeds, on their knees, and duck walking, down to the back of the machine shed, then up along the side. The driver had parked only a couple of feet from the main door.
"Take a chance?" Virgil asked.
"The lights are on the other side of the house. I think they'd be paying attention over there."
"Cover me, then."
Stryker snuggled down with the machine gun, and Virgil crawled along the ground next to the door, behind the truck. Missouri plates. He heard a rattling and froze.
Nothing.
He fumbled in his pocket, found a pen, wrote the number in the palm of his hand, and then again on his forearm. He was about to start back when a thought occurred to him. He'd just rewired the lights on his trailer connection, and if this Dodge was anything like his truck... He groped around for a minute, then risked a quick flash with his light, well under the truck bed. Spotted the wires, got a grip on them, and hung on them all of his weight, yanking until something came free. He risked another flash. Hell, the first one had worked, and saw raw copper on 2 wires.
That should do it, he thought.
Then the dog barked. Once.
Fucking dog in the truck. And not a small one.
He said aloud, "I'm coming." And he scuttled back across the face of the building into the dark beside Stryker, and the dog barked again several times.
"What the hell was that all about?"
Stryker whispered as the duck walked away. The dog started barking again, but the sound was muffled by the truck cab, and nobody came out of the house. 50 yards out, they were on their feet, hunched over. And then 100 yards out, they were upright and moving away. They found their nest and settled into it.
"Wires," Virgil said. "Whenever we find out who this guy is, well, I'm afraid he'll have a moving violation, if we need it."
"A moving violation?" Stryker asked.
"I yanked the wires on a taillight," Virgil said.
"That'll go on his permanent record," Stryker said.
"Yes, it will."
"When that dog... You owe me money for a laundry bill." Nothing more happened at the house for half an hour, when the door opened, and 3 men, one of them Fur, came out, looked around, and then crossed the yard to the machine shed. They were inside for 10 minutes, then came out carrying 4 5-gallon metal gas cans. They loaded them carefully in the truck's camper, moved some things around in the interior of the camper, went back inside the shed, got 4 more cans. They closed the doors on the camper, talked for a few minutes, and then the driver got back in the truck, waved, and pulled out. The left rear taillight was out.
"Let's go," Stryker said.
They eased away in the dark, and 200 yards out tried to cross to the road. Stryker got tangled in the fence and ripped his coat, said, "Damn it, I just bought it this spring." And then they were on the road jogging. The moon, on its way down, broke through the ragged clouds on the back edge of the squall line and helped them along.
"We're there,"
Stryker said, his face a pale oval in the light from his GPS. They cut across the ditch back into the dark, risked a couple of flashes, got the truck, pulled around in a circle, and bumped back onto the road. "Let's go talk to the computer," he said. "See where this guy is coming from."
"Two possibilities," Virgil said. "The gas cans have something in them besides gas. Maybe in addition to gas. Get some plastic chemistry flasks, slip them down in there, fill it the rest of the way with gasoline."
The other possibility, Stryker reached overhead and started pulling gaffer tapes off the internal lights. "The other possibility is that there really is gas in the cans, but our guy couldn't stop because he couldn't risk being seen. A guy on the run, or being really careful."
"Careful about what?"
"Say he's the shooter," Virgil said. "Coming in from someplace else, Kansas City most likely, with the Missouri plates. You could get a pretty damn good shooter in Kansas City. So he fills it up just before he leaves town, drives up here, does the job, picks up an extra 20 gallons, and that'll get him all the way back. Never stops at a gas station. Nobody ever sees him. He's not in any security tapes. How far could you go with a full tank and 40 gallons? They both thought a while, and then Stryker said, "At least to Kansas City."
"But then," Virgil asked, "why didn't they just put it in the tank here? 15 gallons, anyway."
Stryker said, "There's something else in the cans, Virgil."
"That would be my thought," Virgil said.
"Another 2 miles.
Unless he's just picking up some lawnmower gas," Stryker said.
There was a light in the east when they pulled into the courthouse. Stryker led the way into the office, where a dispatcher lifted a hand inside his plexiglass cage, and Stryker got on a computer and ran the Missouri plates. They had a return in 10 seconds. "Dale Donald Evans of Birmingham, Missouri." Birmingham was just outside Kansas City. With his name and birth date, they ran Evans through the NCIC and came up with 6 hits. "Burglary, burglary, burglary, assault, theft, assault. Done 2, 3, 5 years total, all in Missouri," Stryker said.
"Thought they gave you the first 3 burglaries for free," Virgil said.
"Not in Missouri, apparently. Or maybe he stole something big. Or from somebody big." Virgil tapped the screen. "You know what he is? He's a trusted small-timer. Did his time, kept his mouth shut. So now he's a driver. Run up to Minnesota, pick up a load, a few beat-up cans of gas mixed up with some firewood and a chainsaw and maybe a generator and some tools. Nobody gives him a second look."
Stryker leaned back in his chair.
"I could use some recommendations about what to do about all this."
"We need to take a meeting," Virgil said. Davenport groaned into the phone.
"Virgil, God damn it."
"Get your big white ass out of bed and call the DEA," Virgil said. "I need to talk to one of their serious guys, like right now."
"You got something?"
"Biggest meth lab in the history of big meth labs," Virgil said.
"Maybe."
He could hear Davenport yawning.
"Okay, I can call a guy. But is there some reason that you're calling me at 5:30 in the morning?"
"Yeah. About 40 gallons of meth is driving downtown to Kansas City. We need to get somebody on it. We figure the feds are as good as anyone."
A DEA agent called back 20 minutes later. With Stryker sitting across from him, Virgil gave the agent a précis of the investigation, the killings, the ethanol plant, and what they thought. The DEA man, whose name was Ronald Pirelli, and who said that he was in Chicago, said, "Sit there at that telephone." 10 minutes later, another DEA man called and said, "Can you brief a team in Mankato in 4 hours?
"We could do that," Virgil said.
"Why Mankato?"
"Because it's almost halfway between here and there. 10 o'clock at the Days Inn."
"We could be there in 2 hours, Virgil said.
"Got the big guy flying in from Chicago," the DEA man said. "He can't make it before 10.
Virgil hung up and said to Stryker, "We started a prairie fire, boy. You're going to be a hero."
"Either that or I'll be a farmer again," Stryker said. But he looked happy enough. "Rather leave that to Joni, tell you the truth."
Virgil retrieved his car from Stryker's house, drove back to the Holiday Inn, tried to catch an hour's sleep, and failed.
Instead, he got caught in a recursive semi-waking dream about dogs and running in the rain. At 7:30, he got up, found a good, clean, conservative, modest mouse t-shirt, took a shower, and went and got Stryker. Stryker was wearing a necktie. He looked at Virgil's shirt and said, "Now that's nothing but cold, deliberate insolence." On the way to Mankato, the accountant called on Virgil's cell phone. "When can we get together?" "We've been called to a meeting up in Mankato. We'll be back this afternoon. You got something?" "A headache and a big bill. And I have to say our friend is in worse shape than we thought. I can't prove it because it doesn't have anything to do with numbers. But he has extra money coming in. Quite a bit of it. I'm going to bed. Call me when you get back." "Be careful. Keep your mouth shut," Virgil told her. The guy from Chicago was Ronald Pirelli, who'd called that morning. He was a short, dark man wearing a black linen jacket, black slacks, a French blue shirt, and $600 sunglasses. He had three other agents with him, all casually dressed, and all with the wary look of the DEA. FBI agents, Virgil thought, usually look sleek. DEA guys usually look like they'd just driven a Jeep back from Nogales with the windows down. Pirelli had arrived a couple of minutes before Virgil and Stryker. They followed him down to the room rented by another of the agents, and they all introduced themselves. And Pirelli asked Virgil, "What's with the t-shirt?" Virgil said, "I thought my Sheryl Crow shirt might piss you off." "Hey." Pirelli was affable, the other agent skeptical, watching Stryker carefully, and Virgil even more carefully. One of them said, "You got kind of a weird reputation, dude. Everybody in Minneapolis calls you that fucking Flowers." Stryker laughed and said, "You want to know something? He's been seeing my sister, and just the other night, honest to God, she's a farmer, she's got no contact with Minneapolis. I asked her what she was doing, and she said, 'Going out with that fucking Flowers.'" The agents all laughed, and the skepticism receded a little, and Pirelli said, "Give us what you've got.